This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 19, 2004, at WBAI in New York. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Israel attacks a peaceful Palestinian demonstration in Rafah, killing at least 13. We get the latest from the Gaza Strip. India's new prime minister is sworn in. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. While courts-martial proceedings were held in Baghdad today in the Abu Ghraib prisoner abuse scandal, another court-martial began at Fort Stewart, Georgia. The attorney for the U.S. staff sergeant charged with desertion asked the military judge to dismiss the charges because the infantryman is a citizen of Costa Rica. Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia says he saw Iraqi prisoners treated with great cruelty when he was put in charge of processing detainees a year ago at Al Asad, an Iraqi airbase occupied by U.S. forces in what Mejia calls an oil-driven war. Mejia could receive the same sentence given today to Army Specialist Jeremy Sivitz, who pleaded guilty to his involvement in the torture at Abu Ghraib prison and was sentenced to 1 year in prison and a bad conduct discharge. Texas executed a severely mentally ill man last night, despite a recommendation by the state's Board of Pardons and Paroles to commute his sentence. From KPFT in Texas, Erica McDonald reports.
Kelsey Patterson died by lethal injection last night after Governor Rick Perry denied granting clemency. In announcing his decision, Perry did not mention the almost unheard-of recommendation by the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles to commute Patterson's sentence. Instead, the governor said he sided with numerous state and federal courts that rejected appeals based on Patterson's schizophrenia. Defense attorney Gary Hart.
It just seems like the governor doesn't understand what executive clemency is about. The point of executive clemency is you look to the things that, as I said, the courts are either unable or unwilling to do anything about. The Board of Pardons and Paroles seem to understand that just fine. I don't understand why the governor doesn't understand it.
Hart was unable to communicate with Patterson before he died. The inmate thought his lawyer was part of a government plot to murder him and steal his money. Amid other delusional ramblings while strapped to the gurney, Patterson said, "Give me back my rights, give me back my life," before the lethal chemicals took effect. At 6:20 p.m., he became the ninth Texas inmate executed this year. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
Senate Democrats and the White House struck a deal regarding judicial nominations. Jenny Johnson reports from our D.C. Bureau.
Up to 25 non-controversial judicial nominees got the go-ahead for confirmation voting from Senate Democrats in a deal struck with the White House. The Democrats were blocking confirmation of any of the Bush administration's nominations after the president appointed two highly controversial nominees while Congress was in recess. Now, a deal has been struck in which the White House agrees not to use its powers to bypass the Senate with recess appointments, and Democrats agree to allow confirmation on current appointees. Roger Pilon, president of legal affairs at the Cato Institute, thinks this deal to confirm non-controversial nominees is bad for the Republicans.
These are people who have no track record of standing for the principles that Bush allegedly stands for. The Republican Party also gives up the political advantage which they would gain from having the numbers to show that the Democrats have been stonewalling.
Seven nominees remain blocked by the Democrats despite the deal. For FSRN, I am Jenny Johnson.
Immigrant New Yorkers held a vigil mourning the civilian casualties of the war on terror today in front of the 9/11 Commission hearings in New York City. Gail Walker was there.
While former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and other representatives of government testified before the commission about their experience during the September 11th attacks, representatives of immigrant communities outside the hearing explained how the voices of their communities are not being heard. Arti Shahani of Freedom for Families.
Now Tom Rich is testifying about his role in the whole domestic war on terror and the national security agenda. And we want to make sure that we can't actually be inside on the floor giving our own testimony about our own families. There is a huge piece of the puzzle that's missing, and that's what's happening to poorer working people of color, specifically immigrants in the United States right now.
According to immigrant advocates, over 300,000 people have been detained or deported since September 11, 2001. Nonetheless, Sam Quay of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund is cautiously optimistic.
It's a long-haul fight, but we're definitely optimistic to get this anti-immigrant climate changed.
Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gail Walker.
Yesterday, the U.S. House defeated a proposal that would require hospitals to fingerprint or photograph illegal immigrants to qualify for federal payments for emergency care. California and Texas representatives led the argument against the bill, saying it would turn hospital officials into Border Patrol agents and keep immigrants from seeking medical attention. The bill was defeated 331-88, with most Republicans and virtually all Democrats against it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
On the heels of the widespread house demolitions and missile attacks on various parts of the Gaza Strip over the past few days, today Israeli army helicopter gunships and tanks opened fire on a non-violent civil demonstration in Rafah. 13 Palestinians are reported dead, including 2 children, with more than 50 people injured. The incident occurred as some 3,000 Palestinian civilians from Rafah, mostly youth, were peacefully demonstrating to protest the recent Israeli military operation in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Today's attack brings the death toll to 37 in what's being called the bloodiest military operation since the beginning of the Second Intifada. We're joined now by Raji Sarani from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Welcome, Raji Sarani. Can you begin by describing what happened today in Rafah?
There was very peaceful demonstration, and people were simply protesting the siege in Rafah and protesting what the Israeli bridge and occupation doing. All of a sudden, without any short notice, I mean, the Apache hit and the tanks and the soldiers began to shoot. So it was directed by 3 levels, Apache and tanks and firearms. And as a result of that, on the spot, I mean, many reportedly dead and many has been injured. This is, I mean, real war crime in the daylight. Take consideration that in the 36 hours before this real war crime take place, 23 people, among them 19 civilians, has been killed, and the Israeli army really terrorizing the entire area of Tel Sultan. Ambulances can't go in and out. Ration and food, I mean, mission impossible to get it inside.
Now, Rafah is administered by a UN agency. We're hearing reports from hospitals that they're overwhelmed. They can't deal with the many Palestinians who are coming in injured. What has the United Nations said, if anything, to stop these blatant attacks by Israel?
Well, UN, in a clear-cut way, do condemn, I mean, the Israeli act, especially that plan of this operation to demolish another 600 houses. Where I expected another 8,000 to 9,000 people would be again, I mean, homeless, and for the second or third time, refugees in their life.
One would imagine a almost humanitarian crisis occurring if so many people are homeless, injured, and hungry. Who's dealing with the crisis? What are Palestinians doing to get food and basic needs?
The most fantastic thing in this intifada, the wonderful and fantastic solidarity and warmth between the Palestinians themselves, and there's quite a lot of, I mean, of cooperation on this level. But really, I mean, we are in already disastrous situation. The Gaza Strip, 5% unemployed and 81% under poverty line. Now, in Rafah, that's much, much worse. And that's why UNRWA, I mean, can't really allocate these 20,000 people and rehabilitate them in new houses. Maybe 2,000 people has been, replaced, but the rest of them, I mean, really homeless, literally, and they have no income, and it's a very disastrous area by all standards and meanings.
Just finally, Raji Sarani, the excuse that we're getting reported here in the press from Israel for this most recent attacks is that they're going after the tunnels that have been built that they say Palestinians are using for smuggling weapons from Egypt. How do you respond to that?
This is totally false. I mean, this is very intentional destruction. The Israeli army, general of staff and minister of defense said before this operation that they are targeting 600 houses. They use tear gas, they use rubber bullets. Israel using against civilians Apache guided missiles. They are using tanks missiles and bullets in order to ward any people. They are distorting facts. They are lying. They have to know the Palestinian blood is not cheap.
Raji Sarani from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. In Washington, D.C., public hearings on the detainee prison abuse scandals convened with testimony from some of the top U.S. military commanders in Iraq. Selena Masuda reports from Capitol Hill.
No doubt we have made mistakes in Abu Ghraib. I accept responsibility for that setback, but the failures of a few will not keep the many courageous young men and women of ours from accomplishing their dangerous and important work to defend the nation abroad.
General John Abu Zaid, head of the U.S. Central Command, testified in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee on Wednesday along with Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, senior commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and their judge advocate generals. All three testified on their knowledge of the prison abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib, where several soldiers have been accused of sexually humiliating and physically abusing detainees. U.S. Army Specialist Jeremy Sivitz was the first of the accused to be tried. Sivitz faces a year in jail, and he has agreed to testify against other soldiers involved. All of the soldiers refused to plead guilty, like Sivitz, and claimed that their superiors not only allowed but encouraged such behavior. However, after speaking to his inspector general, General Abu Zaid did not believe that abuse was a systemic problem.
I specifically asked the IG of the Army, did he believe that there was a pattern of abuse of prisoners in the Central Command area of operation, and he looked at both Afghanistan and Iraq, and he said no.
Critics of the military's actions on these abuses, like Mark Galarso, senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch, say that these abuses are not isolated incidents.
What we're seeing in Iraq, it's not just a few bad apples, it's the whole orchard. Take a look at the news that came out regarding the number of investigations that are ongoing. Now we're up to 75. And just today there was a newspaper report that came out of the Denver Post talking about an Iraqi general who had surrendered to U.S. forces. He was stuffed into a sleeping bag and suffocated. This is not one instance of torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment.
Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona read from a report conducted by Army Major General Antonio Taguba, who investigated the abuse allegations, to Sanchez.
Soldier number four, have you heard him insinuate to guards to abuse inmates of any type of manner? Yes. What was said? Answer. Quote, they said, loosen this guy up for us. Make sure he has a bad night. Make sure he gets the treatment. You see my point? How do we respond to that?
Sir, I do not believe those orders were misinterpreted. The procedures that General Miller and I had discussed, that he had recommended, were very detailed, and it very clearly stated that MPs were involved in passive enabling of those operations and had no involvement in the conduct of interrogation.
None of the victims of the Abu Ghraib abuses were terror suspects. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
Is it true or not that some of the people in this abuse photos, some of these people are common criminals?
Sir, that is absolutely correct. We know from the list of victims that that's true.
So now we know that the abuse wasn't just directed at the high-value targets, but there was abuse going on just in general.
Absolutely correct, sir, and they should not have been in that cell block. That violated our orders and our policies.
So one thing we can find out pretty quickly is it's in October. It's done to people who are not high-value targets. That jail was just sort of screwed up.
Certainly, it would suggest by the investigations and the evidence we have that that statement is accurate. Yes, sir.
After the public hearing, the Senate Armed Services Committee convened a closed session to receive classified documents. Congressional Representative Maxine Waters of California will propose 8 amendments this week to the Defense Authorization Bill that would address prison abuse cases, issues around detention, and U.S. compliance to the Geneva Convention. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Selena Masuda of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
This morning, Halliburton shareholders and company officials were met with protests against war profiteering during their annual meeting in Houston. Halliburton, the largest oil and gas services company in the world, has been the number one financial beneficiary of the war against Iraq. From Pacifica Station, KPFT, Renee Feltz reports.
Today's protest against war profiteers began with a rally in a downtown Houston park. Terry Allison of Military Families speak out.
Nowhere can I find in the oath that he took where he was asked to fight and to give his life if necessary for the corporate bottom line.
Allison's sentiments were backed by her fellow protester, Rania Masri, of the Institute for Southern Studies.
Halliburton needs to get out of Iraq. Halliburton needs to be held responsible for its abuse of taxpayer money, its violation of U.S. law. And at the same time, all our military in Iraq needs to be brought home. We need to have a change in foreign policy, and we need to return Iraq back to its rightful owners, back to the Iraqis.
Masri and many of today's protesters were familiar with an alternative shareholder report issued this week by CorpWatch. The report documents a 680% increase in contracts awarded to Halliburton after Vice President Dick Cheney took office. The report also documents accusations against Halliburton of more fraud, waste, and corruption than any other Iraq contractor. Former employee Henry Bunting, who first blew the whistle on the company's procurement practices after working in Kuwait in 2003, is cited in the report.
I put out a bid for exercise equipment, and there was over a $60,000 real cost savings by placing that order in the United States. There was a second order, two additional wrecks for basically the same equipment. It went over to the subcontract administration group because they issued a subcontract for all the exercise equipment, including service. Did they put it out for competitive bid? I don't know. My guess is they bought it locally and they paid a premium for it. Taxpayers got stuck for another $60,000+.
Concern about such allegations surfaced at today's shareholder meeting. Of the five measures voted on, three asked for more accountability from company officials. Jim Doherty presented a measure on behalf of the New York City Police and Fire Department pension funds, which asked the company to review its operations in Iran, a nation designated by the U.S. State Department as a sponsor of terrorism.
We had a very good vote today. Almost 22 million shares voted in favor of our resolution. So that means that we're going to be able to come back next year, and the year after that, we're going to be able to continue to raise these issues.
Officials denied Global Exchange's Medea Benjamin and CorpWatch's Prothop Chatterjee entrance to the meeting, even though they had either shares or a proxy. But as Benjamin describes, five protesters were able to get their point across with direct action.
And then there were five people who chained themselves to the banister of the third floor of the hotel outside the meeting. They had blood poured on them. They were yelling, Halliburton, shame on you.
Protesters were taken to a city jail and are expected to be charged with criminal trespassing. After the initial rally this morning, samba musicians led a high-spirited march of pig-snouted protesters to the downtown hotel hosting Halliburton's shareholder meeting. Outside the hotel, over 500 protesters, puppets, and a giant inflatable pig lined both sides of the streets. Some locked arms and blocked a driveway. Protest mascot Hallibacon fed from a trough of corporate welfare notes. Billionaires for Bush welcomed the meeting.
I cannot thank the people of America enough for the riches I have earned under this administration.
Members of the anti-war group Code Pink dropped a banner from their 14th floor hotel room in the shape of a pink slip, which read, Dick Cheney in bed with Halliburton, and we got screwed. Before today's rally outside the meeting ended, protesters carried out a die-in a block away in front of Halliburton's world headquarters. In a prepared statement, Halliburton said protesters, quote, don't have the facts right, but they still have a right to speak up. Halliburton said it would continue its work in Iraq under U.S. military contracts. With help from Sophia Vasilakidis, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
India's new prime minister was sworn in today, and it was not Sonia Gandhi, wife of assassinated leader Rajiv Gandhi. Gandhi announced yesterday to her Congress party that she was stepping aside to allow 71-year-old Oxford-educated economist Manmohan Singh to be India's new prime minister. Singh is a fierce proponent of economic liberalisation and spent many years working at the IMF. A Sikh, Singh will be the first member of a religious minority to be India's head of state. This comes as many religious minorities around India are hoping for better days under the secular Congress governing coalition, especially the nation's Muslims who were persecuted and massacred during the previous BJP administration. As FSRN's Binu Alex reports, many Muslims are hoping that a new government might even bring them justice they were denied while the BJP ruled India.
A new dawn has begun for India. The political forces that many Indian citizens and international human rights organizations blame for the massacre of more than 2,000 Muslims 2 years ago has fallen. The people of India rejected the Bharatiya Janata Party candidates, and even a high-tech shining campaign could not save the BJP party and its alliance. Lancy Lobo is a Christian priest, and like majority of political analysts, Lobo says the BJP underestimated the poor people of this country.
But actually these elite, they consider the masses as foolish and rustics and peasants to be ruled, and except election times, as the poor may not assert. Poor can be hoodwinked, they can be diverted attention to through Hindutvization and anti-Muslim, anti-minority or Christian feelings. So they keep them engaged in diversionary tactics.
But these same poor masses made a U-turn and elected a secular Congress party to lead the country for the next 5 years. Even in a polarized state like Gujarat, the BJP was destroyed. Muslim activists like Hanif Lakdawala feels the change will have a major impact on Muslims in Gujarat.
Because still now, Muslims of Gujarat always feel that there's BJP at Gujarat and BJP at center. And there is collision between the state and the center. And that's why we are feeling very, very helpless. Now, with, in a way, secular government coming at center, we feel hopeful that our fight for justice for the victims of 2002 violence can take some momentum.
In contrast to the right-wing claims, where the Muslims were portrayed as betrayers, the relations between traditional rivals India and Pakistan has improved. With development plank not working well for the BJP, there are fears that the party might abandon moderate leadership and revert to its sectarian anti-Muslim roots and thus spoiling the relations again. But overall, a majority of those who witnessed the 2002 carnage see a ray of hope in the new government bringing justice to the victims. Batuk Vora is a former politician and currently writes columns for various international publications.
Guilty of this entire carnage, or like Chief Minister and the BSP gang, if they are brought to book and if they are arrested or if they are charged and something like that, if can be done, we have a better hope. This kind of prosecution may take place. Too early to say what will happen, but Gujarat will be on the focus, no doubt about it.
In what is known as the Best Bakery case, where the accused were set free by the trial court and then rearrested on a Supreme Court intervention for killing some 14 Muslims, the case is now shifted from Gujarat. With a change in government and judicial intervention, Muslim social workers like Sophia Khan hopes that the nightmares she and her community faced should never return.
The way the prosecution handled the cases here was in a partisan manner. The accused, roaming around freely threatening the victims, is shielded by the government and will now have some fear in their mind. Overall, it seems a minority have found some breathing space in the midst of fascism unleashed by the BJP government.
From Ahmedabad in India, Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Women's reproductive health issues have been in the forefront of the news lately, with the emphasis on protecting the right to abortion and making emergency contraception or Plan B more easily available. Meanwhile, another women's reproductive health issue is unfolding in doctors' offices, hospitals, and sometimes courtrooms. It's the issue of women's shrinking childbirth options. Melinda Tuhus has the story from New Haven, Connecticut.
Dina Driscoll is the mother of three children, ages 5, 3, and 10 months. After a 36-hour first labor that included half a dozen failed interventions, her doctors performed a cesarean section to deliver her son, Tommy. Driscoll says full recovery took 6 months, and then
the hunt was on to find a doctor that was willing to do a vaginal
birth with me, which they call VBACs, and that was not easy.
The search was tough due to reversal of a trend of several years earlier when more obstetricians and nurse midwives were willing to let women deliver vaginally after a previous C-section. Now relatively few are. The rate for VBACs dropped drastically, and the overall C-section rate, including first and subsequent births, stands at 27%. Several factors are driving the increase, including the older average age of first-time mothers and a marked rise in obesity among pregnant women. But Dr. Charles Lockwood, chief of obstetrics and gynecology at Yale New Haven Hospital, sees one main reason for the rise in the C-section rate.
A substantial proportion of that reflects a more conservative attitude by obstetricians in diagnosing fetal distress and trying to avoid vaginal deliveries that require forceps or vacuum because they're worried about being sued, and perhaps overcalling fetal distress.
Even though there may be no real problem, and even though most babies in similar situations in the past were delivered vaginally with satisfactory outcomes, medical providers are opting more and more to perform cesareans. The operation is major surgery with its own set of risks, but almost all mothers will choose a C-section if they believe it's better for their baby. Although statistics show no improvement in birth outcomes with the increased section rate, not doing a timely C-section is the major reason most parents sue their doctors. A call to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, or ACOG, picked up this message.
If you are an ACOG member and would like a copy of the new 27-page booklet titled What to Do If You Are Sued, please leave your name along with your ACOG ID number.
Members of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America handle most of these lawsuits. Association spokesman Carlton Carl says fear of a lawsuit should not be a determining factor in delivering health care. But ACOG says among OBGYNs, 75% have been sued at least once. More than half of jury awards are now over $1 million, and ACOG is calling for a cap on damage awards for pain and suffering. But Carl of the Lawyers Association says doctors have an attitude problem.
They don't trust the American people serving on juries to listen to all of the evidence from both sides and make an intelligent decision. That is offensive and, quite frankly, un-American.
Lockwood agrees with the lawyers that the medical profession hasn't done enough to discipline bad doctors, but he says the lawsuits are driving up medical malpractice insurance rates to $160,000 per physician per year. Lockwood says these costs, combined with the damage a litigious frame of mind does to the doctor-patient relationship, has helped drive 20% of OBGYNs in Connecticut out of obstetrics. Nationally, women in rural areas and poor women are most at risk of losing needed care. While the controversy rages, more healthcare providers are either leaving the field, spending less time with their patients due to financial pressures to increase their patient load. All of these elements reduce choice for women. But fortunately for Dina Driscoll, after much searching, she found someone willing to do VBACs for her second and third babies. She went to a midwife and a birthing coach, and she had both her daughters without any intervention.
We went through the pros and cons of a VBAC versus a cesarean, and I can't understand how anybody with that knowledge would ever opt for the cesarean.
In New Haven, I'm Melinda Tuhus for FSRN.
And as we close today's newscast to commemorate what would have been the 79th birthday of Black Power leader Malcolm X, we listen to the words he delivered in one of his historic speeches, Don't Sit In, Stand Up.
The word sit itself is not an honorable tag. Anybody can sit. Also, we feel that to try and sit down in another man's restaurant to drink a cup of coffee is insane. If I were in the South and a Southerner didn't want me to eat in his restaurant, and I forced my way in and then let him go back in his kitchen and prepare some coffee for me to drink, I'd consider myself insane to drink it. We don't think that that's the solution. We feel that rather than to force our way into someone else's restaurant or public place that they have established, that we should get our own. Once we have our own, we're respected for the fact that we can create our own. And that's equality right there.
Malcolm X in an historic speech, Don't Sit In, Stand Up. This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.